Welcome back for another episode of the Beyond Body podcast. I'm your host, Mia Findlay, an eating disorder survivor, advocate, and recovery coach. And this podcast is all about motivating, inspiring, and most importantly, getting real about mental health. As always, I acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land in which I am seated and recording today, the Gadigal people. I send my respect to all elders and ancestors and any First Nations people listening. So happy to have you with me for another week and very honoured to be bringing you today's episode, which is featuring Christy Amadio, certified CCI recovery coach and founder of Recovered Living NZ. Christy is a highly reputable person within the coaching space in particular. She's been doing incredible work. She has been demonstrating her skills as a pioneer in the eating disorder space for some time. And today we are talking about her latest feat, which is establishing a residential in New Zealand under Recovered Living NZ. She's here to talk about her own recovery, her experiences with treatment, and how those things combined inspired her to provide something which, prior to her work, really didn't exist, particularly in New Zealand. So this is a fascinating and incredible conversation. I hope you get a lot out of it, particularly obviously the core of everything that we're trying to do as recovery coaches, which is spreading hope, spreading the possibility of what life can be without an eating disorder and hopefully paying forward what we have been fortunate enough to receive. And Christy is certainly the epitome of that message and that intent. So enjoy. Christy, thank you so much for coming on the Beyond Body podcast this week. We're so excited to have you because you have some incredibly exciting things to share. Before we jump into the content of the episode, can you give our listeners a little bit of background about you, your history through recovery, and kind of how you've come to be doing what you're doing now? Let everybody know sort of a little bit of your history.
Absolutely. And thank you for having me. So for myself, I had an eating disorder for 14 years. So I used to be an elite athlete. And so I grew up in this world that was very body centric and body focused. And I learned from a young age that actually I could change my body and have the body I wanted. But the piece that I never glued together was it came at a cost. And so I stuck with the sport for a while. And when I eventually retired from competitive sport, I just remember feeling this massive fear of like, well, what happens if I'm not training this much? And what happens if I'm not burning all these calories? And so the eating disorder that was definitely, there's no question, it was already there. It just really expanded at that time. And so I was living in Australia and I sought treatment in Australia for my eating disorder multiple times. And eventually I was told that I'd have to learn to manage my eating disorder because I'd had it for so long. And I didn't even question that. I just thought, okay, I can manage things. And so I actually got to a point in my life where I would call it, I was surviving. I wasn't thriving. I was existing. I wasn't living. But to me, that was okay because that was better than being in the very depths of an eating disorder. And I think I began to learn how to settle. And so, you know, I had a life, I had relationships, I traveled, I had a job, but every morning I would wake up and think, what did I eat yesterday? What am I going to eat today? And I would get this sort of clench of fear in my heart about how can I avoid this? Or no, I have to do extra exercise because of this. And it was this constant calculation. And I don't think when I eventually told people that I was going to treatment again for my eating disorder, people were genuinely surprised, some of them. They said, I never would have known. Yeah. And I think they're the people that my heart feels for the most. I think the people that are living lives or having lives with secret eating disorders that nobody knows about, because it really is a mental illness. It lives in your head. And so I was told, yeah, that I'd have to learn to manage it. And I eventually moved to New Zealand and continued to manage my eating disorder until I relapsed. And I sought help again in New Zealand and was told there that, well, because you've had it for so long now, you're now considered chronic and you should expect that you'll have to manage it for the rest of your life. And I remember something in me at that point. I didn't settle in that moment. I didn't go, oh, okay, we're back here again. I just went, you know what? This isn't living. Like, I don't want to have periods of my life where I'm struggling to this degree. And I don't want to have periods of my life where I constantly struggle at a lower level, because that's not living. And I got very fired up about that. And I remember the psychologist said to me, well, you're just going to have to accept that. That's part of your work. And I just went, no. So I went home and Googled, thank goodness for Google. And I think I Googled something like eating disorder treatment worldwide help. Like that was maybe my search string.
Just cast and that net. Just, see what exactly, comes back.
I went, I am desperate, and just put it out everywhere. And I think the second hit that came back was this treatment center in America that Carolyn Costin, she wrote the 8 Keys to Recovery book that she had created herself. And I rang them up and I said, hey, I don't think you can help me because I'm chronic, but... And the lady on the phone, her name's Vicky, I love her forever. And she said, well, I'm going to stop you there. She said, we believe that anybody can be recovered. And she said, it doesn't matter how long you've been sick. It doesn't matter how sick you've been. It doesn't matter how many times you tried to recover. What matters is the decision you make today. And a little tiny seed of hope was planted, but then most of me went, yeah, but I still can't recover. But she was the first person that ever told me that I could. And so I went through this sort of very long comprehensive phone assessment. And at the end of it, I said, you know, I would really like to come to your treatment center because I had to do something. And she said, that's great. You know, it's 12. And I said, oh, how much is it? And she said, it's $1,200. And naively, I was like, oh, is that like a month? Yeah. And she goes, no, that's a day. And I said, like, that, to me, that was just laughable. And I just said, I'm sorry, like, I just can't do that. So I ended the call. And a week later, I actually phoned her back and I said, Vicky, I said, I've got a deposit for a house, but I'm going to put that towards treatment because, because I said, I can't live like this. I just can't do it. And so I went with this view of going for 6 weeks and I was going to be recovered in 6 weeks. And in my first week in treatment, I was just blown away because it wasn't a hospital. It was a home. They hired staff, some of them who had had eating disorders and were recovered. And for the first time, I was actually around people that believed I could. The culture was positive and I could actually, I didn't believe that I could get better, but I hoped that I could get better. And I think that was the first time I'd ever had hope. And so I said to the clinical director, I said, Nora, this is going to take a bit longer than 6 weeks, isn't it? And she goes, about 6 months, sweetheart. And I went, oh boy. And I called my parents and I'll forever be grateful to them because I said, Dad, you know, I think I can do this, but I need more time. And before I'd even finished those words, he just said, okay, we'll do it. And, you know, I'm incredibly, incredibly fortunate that my parents are in a position to support me through that journey. And I did 7 months in America and it wasn't like I left recovered. I left in solid recovery, knowing exactly what I had to do in order to be recovered. And it took me several years after that to get to a place of being recovered. And I've always had a vision of bringing that quality and the comprehensiveness of what I was lucky enough to experience in America and bringing it over here. That's always been a vision. It's always been a drive because I'm like, this should be available to us in this country.
Yes, totally. I had such a similar awakening and sort of anger when I hit that 2 or 3 year point where it was my recovery anniversary and everyone was so excited and I was not excited because I was like, I am doing the calculations. I am so paranoid about relapsing and, you know, I'm in this like quasi state in this middle ground being told that that's the end. This doesn't feel like the end point and where it is just doesn't feel like it's sustainable. And that introduction, I made a video and sort of the internet came to me and in my comment section was like, go and find Carolyn Costin, go and, you know, find this terminology around fully recovered. Because with the training of our professionals and a lot of professionals, especially in Australia, they're telling us what they believe to be true, which is that you are managing and maintaining a certain endpoint, a remission sort of ideology, as opposed to what if there's something beyond that. And we have to be, of course, mindful that people are going to approach recovery in different ways and feel like different things are possible for them. But just to leave it on the table for people, I think, is important, to even just open it up as an option for them.
100%.
Otherwise, we're just potentially hiding half of the map from people and telling them like that's the end of your journey when it doesn't have to be. So you then, once fully recovered, you've also gone and trained as a CCI coach. So we're fellow CCI alumni. What motivated you? Was it sort of this experience of this philosophy and then the option of, you know, enacting that as a coach? Did that draw you to that first step of becoming a CCI coach?
Yeah, it's a good question. So before, when I was younger, in my early 20s, I'd actually trained as a counsellor. So I did a Bachelor of Counselling, and I'd always worked with youth. But if anyone with an eating disorder came my way, I'd always just refer on, because I'd just be like, oh, I don't know how to deal with this because I don't know how to deal with myself.
Yes.
You know? And then once I recovered, I actually went back and did my Master's of Counselling, and then began to work in the eating disorder space, and also did the CCI training as well to get that additional piece there. And I think I'd done a lot of peer mentoring through my own recovery. I latched on to, helping others. We kind of recovered together. And then I went back into the counseling field, and I started to get all these referrals for people with eating disorders. And it just felt like, for the first time, putting my hand into a glove and being like, well, I know how to help you now, and I can relate, and I've absolutely got a roadmap, and yes, we can do this, and yes, you can recover. Mm-hmm. And it just snowballed. And so very, very quickly, I was exclusively just seeing people with eating disorders and helping them get better, which is just the biggest buzz. I can never get enough of it. And I think what happened is, when I started to work again in New Zealand, because I moved to the States for a while and worked over there for a couple of years, and when COVID happened, I came back to New Zealand, and I started to work with people in New Zealand, and I was like, what is going on, that these people were so, so sick and needed more support than just outpatient, but they couldn't get it. Because some of the wait lists for treatment here are in excess of 9 to 12 months. And I was like, they don't have 9 to 12 months. And I think I felt that similar sense of just kind of rage, outraged.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, if there's the, you know, one option is they fly to America for treatment, or I was like, well, what if I just started a residential here? Mm-hmm. And it was kind of this pie in the sky sort of pipe dream, but I just started. And I think it's like an analogy for life. Once I started, I was sort of toe deep, then ankle deep, then knee deep. And by the time I was waist deep, I was like, well, I guess I'll just keep going. Yeah. And it wasn't simple, and it took a lot of work, but I think the driver was just recognizing that New Zealand needs more specialized eating disorder support. It needs more access to eating disorder support. And I think I like the idea of being able to offer something different as well.
Yeah, I think we talked about this a little bit when we were chatting beforehand, about the fact that, you know, especially in this space, I remember when I was first getting into advocacy 10 years ago, and I was like, oh, there's people doing this. Like, there's people like working on this. And don't get me wrong, like, fabulous people in the advocacy space who are doing so much with so little and so many fires to put out, that you then get, as you say, toe deep, ankle deep, and you're like, oh no, there's no one for me to go and help. I just have to start the thing that I can see missing. Exactly. Which is what I think is so incredibly admirable about what you've done, because this isn't just a little bit of policy, a little bit of this. This is like quite literally from the ground up building something that previously hasn't existed. And I do know that within sort of like the CCI space that you started doing a lot, within CCI, you are like the live-in recovery coach queen. So you have been on the ground in a day-to-day sense, working alongside people. Did that kind of contribute to what you could see as the necessity of like people needing that constant day-to-day support, care, you know, walking directly alongside them with every like incremental step along the way?
Absolutely. So it was actually when I was in treatment in America that I think there was another client I was in treatment with that had struggled with substance abuse, and she was talking about like a sober coach. And I said to her, what's a sober coach? She's like, oh, when you leave like substance abuse treatment, someone comes and lives with you for a couple of days or weeks and like helps you clean out your closet and get rid of any stuff and just sort of helps you settle in back home. And I was like, they should have that for eating disorders, but they couldn't, because I think with eating disorders, it needs to be someone who really is specialized in sort of knowing all of the things. And so therapists couldn't do it because you're not allowed to live with your clients, right? And when I went over to America, America didn't actually accept my therapy degree. It wasn't in alignment with their universities. And they said, well, you're going to have to go back to study. But I could be a coach. And then I was like, well, if I can be a recovery coach, then I could also be a live-in coach. And so that was sort of the genesis of how live-in started. So I had these amazing experiences where people would invite me into their homes and into their families to help them recover for people who residential treatment maybe hadn't been successful, or maybe they were a mum of four kids and it just wasn't possible. And it's like, all right, let's do recovery at home. And I think it's really given me an appreciation for, you know, I've worked outpatient, I've done live-ins, I've been a client in residential, now I run a residential. So I think I've seen all those different pieces, and what we're trying to do here is try and put as much of that together that we can.
Sure. Can you tell us a little bit about the residential itself in terms of sort of the philosophy, what inspired you to do it? What does it look like? Well, obviously, with the visual version of this podcast at this moment, where I'm going to be putting up all these beautiful videos that Christy has on the website, and all those links to the residential will be down below. But yeah, tell us a little bit about the inspiration, philosophy, kind of the story of how it came to be.
For sure. So Carolyn Coston actually had a lot to do with helping me around the philosophy and setting it up, because the treatment center that I went to that she'd started, it was so successful for me. I was like, well, this is the model that works, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I first started to talk with her about opening a residential treatment center, she was like, of course I will help. And her team that I was in treatment with as well, they all rallied to help. So I feel like I was very supported in the philosophy, the structure, the setup, all of those pieces. And she's still in contact with me today, helping out as well. So I feel very, very fortunate. But essentially, recovered living as a residential treatment center, it's a home. It's not a hospital, it's a home. And so people come and live here, and we have four different levels in our program. So everybody comes in on level one. It doesn't matter where you're at in recovery. Everyone comes in on level one, and we cook for you. We shop for you. We do everything for you. You just have to sit there, and you have to manage eating your food, keeping your food, and dealing with those feelings. And we will support you with that 100% 24/7. We are right there. And for some people, level one is a week. And for some people, level one is 2 months. It really is completely individualized as to where you're at in your recovery. Level two, you start to get more responsibility. And so it's like, well, let's come into the kitchen and start preparing some of your snacks and start experimenting a little bit more with movement. See what it's like to reintroduce movement. You know, let's do some therapeutic groups on that. Let's really unpack what that's like for you. By the time people get to level three, the analogy I have about our different levels is level one, I feel like it's almost like carrying you. Like, we pick you up, we're like, come on, we're going this way, and we carry you. You don't have to do anything. Level two, we're kind of holding your hand, and I wouldn't say dragging you, but we're sort of pulling you forwards and saying, come on, this is the way. Level three, I feel like clients are walking beside us and saying, yes, I want recovery. Like, that ambivalence isn't there so much, but we expect ambivalence on level one and level two. That's why you're on level one and level two. Yeah. Level three, they'll be like, holding our hands and saying, yes, this is all metaphorically, of course, saying, yes, let's let's do recovery, but can you come with me? Because I need help. Mm-hmm. And then level four, it's almost like clients are walking in front of us and saying, hey, I'm doing the thing. Like, you want to come and hang out, or just, you know, like, I'm okay, but just watch me, baby. Yeah. So there's this real piece of ownership that starts to happen as people start to recover and their healthy selves, their healthy voice gets stronger and is like, actually, I'm ready to do whatever it takes, as long as it takes, until it's done. I want recovery. You know, my heart wants recovery. And of course there's moments where the eating disorder gets loud and says, oh, is it actually worth it? But that's why we're here in residential. And so by the time someone leaves on level four, they are grocery shopping for their food, they're cooking, they're eating independently. They're really preparing to either step down into a day program or to return back home. So to me, I feel like our residential setting, it's a preparation for going back out into the world. And for people that live locally or want to do our day program, we have a 7 day a week, 7 hour a day program as well. So that if people want to step down into that and then start picking up some volunteering or some work or some study, whatever that looks like, we can then customize the program a little bit more and say, well, let's give you more of life. Because life can be overwhelming when you've had an eating disorder and done it one way for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And then it's suddenly go and do life. It's like, well, let's do life with support in recovery, because there's a whole lot of things that need to be worked out there. And then we've got a partial program as well, which is 3 hours a day, 3 to 5 days a week. So it's really set up so that we can individualize it as much as possible.
Yeah, it's that integration piece that is just so, so, so essential, where it's, you know, we so often see, particularly in Australia, just that revolving door with hospital settings or clinic settings, and people coming out and saying, you know, I feel like medically something changed, but mentally nothing changed in mm-hmm. terms of me being able to then cope and manage when I get out and when life has to pick up again, because we can't recover in a bubble. The fact that you offer all of those kind of like step down pieces as well as options is so, so, so essential, because we have to test our recovery by being able to merge it with everyday life, right?
The thing that I'm really proud of as well is that it's, because I hear that so often, is people go, well, yeah, medically something changed. But it's like, if people's minds haven't changed, then that's just a pseudo recovery. That's just a time bomb waiting to explode, really.
Yeah. It's kind of like telling people, it's almost, it's almost reminiscent of like just eat a burger.
Right.
If our treatment setup is reflecting like one of the most ignorant viewpoints that, people in general society and the general public hold, which is like, why can't they just eat a burger and get over it? Some of our treatment models are literally just eat a burger 101.
They are. That's right. And I think something that I really appreciated the treatment center I was at was the amount of individual sessions I got. And so we've really mirrored that. So every client here gets to see their individual therapist twice a week. They see me once a week as well. They get to see the dietitian twice a week. We've also got a psychiatrist and a GP that they can see as needed. So we're trying to get as much individuality as possible. It's not possible to have it completely individualized, but as much as we can into that residential setting, which I think is so important, because what's the point of being able to eat and move your body if you haven't dealt with the underlying stuff? So we're sort of like, we're looking at the behaviors, we're looking at the psychology, we're looking at what's unpacking underneath that, we're looking at your medical stability as well. We're, like you said, we're looking at everything.
Yeah, and the physical changes as well. Like, I mean, especially, I think that's where that lived experience has made such a difference to treatment models, where it's, you know, welcoming to that lived experience input, is that so often people are put back out into their life when they may look like they're doing better, but it's when the eating disorder is most active and most distressed, because now it's in a body that it doesn't like and isn't comfortable in. And we haven't had the time or the opportunity to unpack why that might be, and strategies to help to cope with that or to be more tolerant of it. Which is why that mosaic of recovery, being able to work on all these things at once in a doable, incremental, achievable way, super, super important. So what can people expect in terms of the property? You've talked a little bit about sort of like the treatment setup and who they would see. What is an admission like for people in terms of what they could expect from the actual environment, from the accommodation itself? What would that look like for somebody?
For sure. And I think something I'm so proud of is that I really believe that we have a culture here of pro recovery. And I remember comparing my treatment times in Australia to my treatment time in America. In Australia, it felt like it was about who could be the sickest, who could get away with the most.
Totally.
And it was very easy when I was unwell to get drawn into that. And I'll never forget when I went to America, it was Independence Day, 4th of July, and we were eating turkey sandwiches out on the deck. And I remember looking around and being like, there's 11 other people eating their sandwiches. And I was like, is this eating disorder treatment? Because I think I'm in the wrong place, because everyone else was eating except for me. I was genuinely confused, because I'm like, where's the resistance? Where's the pushback? And it doesn't mean there wasn't some, but I think what they did really well at that treatment center was create a culture that was pro recovery. And I see that here with our clients, is they're helping each other out. Like, hey, I'm really struggling with this behavior. And we make it a group. And all right, if you see this person doing that, help them out. Here's how you can help them. And for the person that's struggling, it's like, then start, you need to learn how to reach out in here so that you can learn how to reach out in the world.
I love, because there was a word you said before that really like turned the light on for me, which is responsibility, right? Like, of course, at stage one, we're not expecting people to be taking responsibility for their process. But I say to clients quite often, there is a pretty important turning point in recovery. It's got nothing to do with BMI. It's got nothing to do with how many fear foods are left on your list. And it's got everything to do with how much are you seeing the sort of state of recovery as, like, if we thought of it as a chess game, is it you and your treatment team sitting on either ends of that table, or is it you and you sitting on either side of that table? Because that personal responsibility, that, you know, recognition that this is my life, this is my recovery, I am the one who will either lose out or benefit from what I choose to do next with it, that is such a crucial piece. So when you use that word and sort of spelled out that tiered system, it's just so reflective of where we want people to get to. Like I said, it's not about crossing off all your fear foods, and it's not about, you know, just the body changing and becoming more tolerant of it. That's all part of it. But ideally, it's a total shift in mindset. It's not getting away with it, because you're not getting away with it. Your treatment team members are going home at night without needing to sort up. That's what we want for you. You're not getting away with it. The only person you are getting one over is yourself. And at the end of the day, you're not really, because you're wearing the consequences of getting one over in the process.
100%. And I think, like you said, Mia, like that's our level system right there. To me, that's the clear definition between the difference between level two and level three. Level three is clients are walking beside us being like, hey, let's, I want to do this with you, rather than us being like, come on, we promise you it's worth it.
Yeah. Just try, you can, like, you don't have to go the whole way, but can we go this little bit further and then the proof will start showing up? Totally. So yeah, the property is absolutely beautiful. Whereabouts is it located? What does it look like? What's sort of like the setup in terms of, you know, how the day-to-day living would sort of work for somebody?
Yeah. So I could talk for hours about the property, but when I first saw it, I'd actually come to Christchurch just to get a sense of what properties might be available. So I was actually looking in a different location originally, and this was the second place I looked at in Christchurch. And halfway through, the real estate agent said to me, he said, are you okay? And I'm like, it's just perfect. It was like, I was trying not to let him know how much I liked it.
Yeah. But, poker face.
This place is just perfect. So we're about half an hour north of Christchurch, so the South Island of New Zealand. And it's a really beautiful location. We're out in the country. We've got 12 acres. We've got a lovely lady that has horses in the paddocks around us. So we've got horses and sheep. So it's, you know, I keep saying it, it's not a hospital. It's a home. You know, we get to go out and feed the horses and check out the sheep, and they're lambing right now, which is awesome. In terms of day-to-day, so as in, you know, with any recovery, we eat three meals and three snacks, but we try to mimic daily life as much as possible. So after breakfast, for the people that are approved for movement, so we live really close to a lake, we live really close to the beach, so we'll go out and do a lake walk or a beach walk. We have yoga every Wednesday. The lady that runs it, her name is Jo, so we call it Joga, which is great. So, you know, there's some level of sort of let's move our bodies in ways that feel good, that don't involve punishing yourself or earning calories or burning calories, and let's do it as a group, because then we get to create the experiences that are important, not so much the movement. And then after morning tea, we always have like a primary group. So that could be a primary therapy group. And that can be everything from what's on top right now, like what happened at morning tea for you, because that's big for someone who's on level one. Someone who's on level three might be talking about, well, I'm thinking about who am I and what does my life look like when I leave here. So often primary therapy groups are about what's on top, and it can be anything. But yeah, we can talk about body image. We can talk about recovery and reaching out to family members. I always like to say, don't go to the bookstore for lettuce. Like, we need to figure out who in your family is the right person to ask for help with different situations. Because if you go to the person, if you're looking for lettuce and the person isn't able to metaphorically give you lettuce, then you need to find somebody else.
Yeah.
And then after lunch is generally time for individual sessions. So whether that's with the dietitian, your therapist, the psychiatrist, whoever it is that you need to see. And then as we move towards the afternoon and evenings, there's more therapy groups, but they can be a little bit lighter as well. So it could be around soul, like what are soulful moments that you recall either before your eating disorder? And for people that have had their eating disorder for a long time, like, actually, I don't remember. My life feels so marked by an eating disorder. It's like, well, what kind of soulful moments do you want to have, and how do we go about creating those? And oftentimes it's connection with people, because eating disorders thrive in isolation, but they shrink in relationship and connection with other people. So we start to talk about, you know, let's speak to your soul for the first time. Let's stop and listen.
Beautiful. Yeah, it's that holistic identity, purpose. Because if we're just refining it down to the logistics of an eating disorder, then I just feel like we're missing the whole point that these things are coping mechanisms. They showed up for a reason. They showed up, and now in the recovery process, we have the opportunity to learn from them, which can feel like such a not unproductive, but a counterintuitive thing to people, where they're like, no, but I, you know, should tell it to F off, and I should tell it, you know, to shut up. And it's like, oh no, you could do that. I certainly did that at times, but you're also missing the opportunity to listen to what it was trying to help you with, how it was trying to keep you afloat, how it was trying to communicate your needs and your boundaries. And I love that you touch on help seeking there, because it's never been a mystery to me why Carolyn chose Key 7 to be help seeking, because we are all terrible help seekers.
Right?
I don't think I've met one person who's like, oh no, Mia, help seeking is not a problem for me. I am just incredibly skilled at it and so comfortable with it, and it always goes beautifully for me. So to be able to equip people with those skills that aren't just going to help them during their stay or post their stay, but with their life in general, to make sure that not only do they not go back to this maladaptive coping mechanism, but that they're not as vulnerable to a variety of maladaptive coping mechanisms that can pop up.
And I always say to people, I say, you never go back to who you were before you developed your eating disorder. I say, you go forwards. You take with you the parts of yourself that you want to, that were helpful, that lifted you up, that filled your soul. But I said, but you actually move forwards, because the person that you were before you developed your eating disorder developed your eating disorder. So you don't ever go back. You go forwards.
Yeah, you can't get in a time machine.
No. And it doesn't work, and it wouldn't work.
No, and you can't go in and just pull out all the new wiring that you've been able to build up. It's not just going to fall out of your head. It's like when clients have a couple of wobbly weeks and they're like, Mia, this means I've regressed and, I'm back. It's like the brain, it doesn't work like that. You'll notice that you get back on top of things because that wiring is sitting there waiting for you to re-engage it. So being able to show people that, this is so much more fulsome than just the basics, and that there's a gift there that comes on the other side of that. If this was all about food, I think I would have done it for a year and then I would have given it up because it would be so boring. But being able to, show people there's this huge gift that comes on the other end of this. So when people become unmotivated or exhausted by the process, which they often do, which is totally understandable, if we can plug that back to this isn't all just for recovery, that's still great, but there's so much more amazing stuff that in 10, 20, 30 years, you'll be looking back going, if not for recovery, I may never have adopted that skill or been able to weather this thing that's come up in my life because I would never have had a reason to protect myself or guard myself in the way that I've had to learn to.
Absolutely. And I think too, as someone that's recovered, I know there's often a lot of questions out there that I often get, which is well, do you sometimes think about restricting your food? No. Do you sometimes think about throwing it up? No. I just want to be so clear that recovered means I am done with an eating disorder. You couldn't even pay me to go back to an eating disorder. If someone said, I will give you $1 million, the partner of your dreams, a big house, white picket fence, and travel it, I'd be no, I wouldn't do it. If I had the choice of one more week in this world as a recovered human or another 40 years with an eating disorder, I'd take the week without question. There's nothing about a life with an eating disorder that's attractive to me anymore. But when I was in my eating disorder, it was so attractive because it was safe, it was comfortable, it gave me control, it gave me, all of the things. Whereas now I'm no, there's nothing about that is appealing. And I like my life's too much now. And I like this body because this body gives me this life. And I could have a smaller body. I know how to do that, but I'd have a smaller life. And I'm not prepared to exchange the quality of my life for the size of my body.
Totally. I try to explain it's, when your clients get to the point where they're kind of grieving, really, I could never try to have that body again unless I'm prepared to accept that everything's going to deteriorate. And it's kind of what happens when you mix red and blue paint together? It makes purple and you can't ever separate them out again. That's the truth that's combining. And once you realize that, once you see that, you can't fall for the lie anymore that you can separate out mixed paint, right?
Yeah, I love that analogy.
It's not easy. Not easy to accept that there's not just one more clever way I could do it. There's not a trick that I didn't try.
No.
Right?
No.
I remember writing to Carolyn when I'd had the worst 9 months of my life, lots of loss intersected with the time of COVID, the bushfires where we were down on the south, just horrendous, right? And I said to her, I've always been really convinced that I was recovered. I could have sworn, on anything, but now I feel like I have the concrete printed on my soul proof that I could never go back, not even at times of, distress or tragedy or loss. Does that look like a solution? Because you can just see the lie. You can see.
Because it actually makes your life worse, not better. Whereas in your eating disorder, you're like, oh, this will make my life better if I count my calories so I can focus on that rather than focusing on my life. Or if my body gets thinner, I'll like it more. And then I'll be, no.
No, we did that. We went down that rabbit hole. We have all the evidence to say that is absolute falsehood. So in terms of the residential, who is it available for? Is it just available for people in New Zealand? Because obviously, especially in APAC, we do not have a wealth of residentials as options for people. Who would it be available for if somebody reached out to you from, say, Perth, from Sydney, from America? Who is able to sort of get in contact and see if it's an option for them?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we're available for ages 16 and up. And we're available to everyone all over the world because, you know, I feel so fortunate that I was able to go to treatment in America. And if America had been like, no, you can only come if you're American, I wouldn't be here today. And so we are, yeah, we're open to people. And also we treat all eating disorders as well. And at any stage of an eating disorder, because I know often in Australia and New Zealand, in order to get like the residential level or the hospital level of help that you need to be the sickest of the sick because we're so strapped for resources. But at Recovered Living, I'm like, actually, you need to be at a level of wellness to come in. So we have a minimum BMI criteria of 15. You have to at least be a BMI of 15. And you have to be medically stable because we're not a hospital.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great thing that we're not a hospital, but also if you're not medically stable, then you need to be well enough to come here. And so we've had people that have had their eating disorder for 8 months come through our doors. We've had people that have had their eating disorder for 30 plus years. So I really want to, put it out there that we welcome people from all over, and we've had inquiries from the UK. We've had inquiries from America and Australia as well. I think another piece that's important as well is, so we do have a minimum length of stay of at least 4 weeks. Yeah. And we do that just so that people can get some traction in recovery. But my honest truth is, I think 4 weeks is just a drop in the ocean. And we've had many people that have come through and said, okay, I'm going to do 4 to 6 weeks, and they get here. And kind of like I did, I was going to go for 6 weeks and went, oh, like there's so much more to recovery than just eating the food. And so we're seeing that people are finding ways to stay as long as they can because they're getting the results that they've always wanted to get. And so something that I hope for long term is that the government will fund our facility and so that it can be available to all New Zealanders for free as part of government funding. Right now we have a contract in New Zealand with ACC sensitive claims. So if someone has a sensitive claim that covers an eating disorder, residential treatment is covered for them if they qualify. Otherwise, we are a private pay facility at the moment, but we're also a charitable trust. So our treatment fees are at cost. We're not making money from it. So in Australia, in America at the moment, to go to residential treatment, it's in excess of $2,000 US a day. Our cost at the charitable level is $950 New Zealand a day, which I get is astronomical. It's it's a huge cost, and that's what it does cost in order to have the wraparound team that we have. We have a team of 19 staff for seven clients at the moment. So it's a huge team so that there's enough, not just one-on-one support, but also specialized support in all those different areas.
What would this maybe look like in 5, 10, 20, 30 years? What would you hope that roadmap might look like?
Yeah, I hope that similar to what Carolyn Costin did in America and starting residential treatment is that we can make residential treatment just the gold standard first place that for people who need that level of support that they're able to get straight into that. They don't have to wait a year. They don't have to remortgage their homes. So my hope is that we can open several more Recovered Livings across New Zealand and, hey, even into Australia, why not? And also that we've had some contact from universities who are saying, hey, can we have some of our dietitian students come through your doors to do an internship in treating eating disorders? And I think if we can start with students who are wanting to get into the field and provide some training, I think that then opens up for outpatient services as well to have more specialized staff that understand the treatment model as well.
Incredible. Fantastic. I am so grateful to you for coming and having this chat. I'm so grateful to you just for what you're doing in the space, what you have already done in the space before this residential was even dreamed up. You're such a reputable name in the field, and the fact that you're putting so much of your time and energy and love into this endeavor when, you know, it's very often feels like a huge uphill battle, and being a pioneer in the area is, and especially in this space, is not easy. It's not an easy task. It can be such an uphill battle and sometimes a thankless task at times, but it is so much for the passion of it. And when we've been there, there was something you said earlier in the chat that was such a beautiful encapsulation of the feeling, which is like the hand going into the glove. It fits, it feels right, it feels full circle. And it's, you know, just a beautiful, beautiful contribution to the space. I'm personally so, so grateful.
Thank you so much for your acknowledgement. And I'm so glad we connected. I feel like we've just sort of hit it off, and I hope that you can come and visit one day.
I'd love to. I mean, I told you New Zealand's on the list. I didn't make it over there during COVID when they were meant to open up that damn bubble. So it's still on the list. I will absolutely make that my mission. And that would certainly be a beautiful part of a reason to go over there.
Awesome. All right. Well, hey, thank you so much.
Thanks, Christy.